out, everybody.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm your host, Austin.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
How you guys doing?
I'm all right.
Did I switch it up today?
I'm not well.
You're not well. Austin's
so
not well.
So I don't know if the...
Yes, we know.
But the show must go on.
And then we appreciate you being here, and so does everybody else.
Thank you.
Send some love Austin's way, if you would. He's going through a tough time right now. He needs some extra love.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Josh.
We love Austin here and appreciate him being here despite the circumstances, and especially being here for an episode as disturbing as this one. I mean, this one is, just beyond fucked up, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fucked up on multiple levels as well. We're dealing with a deranged teen killer who made a pact with a demon, two murders, and probably the most disturbing actions done by police that I've seen in a long time. And this is actually over in the UK, which I'm curious to see how many of you who live over there, especially in London, heard of this case before. But this is the murders of Biba Henry and Nicole Smallman. This happened back in 2020, actually, right at the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah.
So that kind of plays a little bit into this case as well. But yeah, truly a disturbing one on so many levels. With that being said, let's just go ahead and get into this story. Starting on June 6th, 2020, two sisters, 46-year-old Biba Henry and 27-year-old Nicole Smallman. I believe she also went by Nikki as well.
Yeah, she did.
But on that day, they headed to Friant Country Park over there in Northwest London. And this is a large park of rolling fields and small wooded areas. They came here to celebrate Biba's 46th birthday with a small group of friends and family. And it was a nice place to meet up, especially during COVID, because obviously there's social distancing. Nobody was really meeting in groups indoors. And so, you know, they knew they were meeting the guidelines for meetups. And so that's why they were over at the park that day. They set up a blanket with cushions and drinks to relax and enjoy each other's company, since socializing during lockdown only a few months earlier had been so rare. But they all enjoyed their evening. It was a wonderful evening, you know, just a truly memorable one. And after midnight, only Biba and Nicole were left. The rest of the group that had been with him had already gone home. The sisters used strings of fairy lights to keep their area illuminated and have fun dancing into the night. One of the final photographs of their night showed the sisters wearing and twirling around the lights. They were unaware that a man had been stalking them from a distance, hiding in the nearby tree line. He was deeply radicalized and had even made a pact with a demon not long before finding the women at the park. At 1:05 a.m., Nicole Smallman sent her boyfriend Adam Stone a text saying this: "I'm dancing in a field." The couple had been dating for 6 years and lived together at his parents' place, and this text was the last that he ever heard from her. That night, Nicole and Biba never returned to their homes.
Biba Henry was born June 5th, 1974. She was a strong woman and a beloved mother, grandmother, daughter, and sister. She was only 5 feet tall, but had a big personality. She was very fun to be around. Many described her as having the heart of a lion, and her mother, Mina Smallman, described her as fiery, like me. She worked as a social worker for Buckinghamshire Council and lived in Brent, which is in northwest London. Before Biba worked as a social worker, she took a job driving disabled children around to their activities. Many remembered her singing while she drove, keeping everyone in good spirits. Her family described her as, quote, a passionate advocate for safeguarding vulnerable children and families. She always fought for what was right and provided for those who were less fortunate. At Buckinghamshire Council, she was considered an exceptional senior social worker. Her little sister was Nicole Smallman, born August 3rd, 1992, and this made her 19 years younger than Biba. They were born of different fathers but shared the same mother, making them half-sisters, although they were very close. Biba's father was Henry Herman, an ABA featherweight champion in 1982, and Nicole's father was a teacher named Christopher, who her mother, Mina, married in 1992. Nicole worked as a freelance photographer and lived with her boyfriend in Harrow, Northwest London. They shared a pet bearded dragon. She had a passion for the arts, and besides her freelance photography, she focused on documentary filmmaking and theater. But her artistic reach didn't stop there, because she was also remembered as a singer with a silky smooth voice. She was also a staunch supporter of humanitarian environmental causes, and because of this and her immense passion for the arts, her parents would laugh about her being, you know, a hippie child of the 60s, and they agreed she was beautiful both inside and out. Biba was always known for her big personality, could really light up a room, while Nicole was more mellow and laid back, and a longtime family friend, whom she called her godbrother, Yayan Ledger, described her, saying, "When she walked into a room, she was like a nightlight. It was subtle, protective, warm." Nicole often saw the beauty in everything, and many loved her calm and positive energy. Both sisters shared the same mother, Wilhelmina Smallman, who went by Mina, and she is a woman of color, and this is very important to keep in mind in this case going forward. Both sisters were always proud of their mother, who once gave up her work at an office job to become a teacher and later joined the priesthood. She actually became the first female archdeacon of the Church of England and is now retired. Mina would also become her daughter's most vocal advocate following the events of June 5th, 2020.
The morning after Biba's birthday party in the park, Nicole's boyfriend, Adam Stone, woke up and noticed that Nicole was not beside him in bed. He checked his phone, but there was no updates. He tried calling, but it went to voicemail. He tried to check her location sharing, but couldn't find her. Adam began calling friends and family, asking if anyone had seen or heard from either Biba or Nicole. But no one had seen them since the birthday party. Other family and friends began calling and texting, trying frantically to find the sisters. Some visited Biba's apartment, but it was very clear that she hadn't returned home. By that night, Biba and Nicole's family called the police to report the sisters missing. Their mother, Mina, provided the police with extensive information about her daughters, including photographs, timeframes, and their last known locations. Police ended up not even visiting the park the following day, even though they promised the family that they would begin inquiries immediately on the women's last known whereabouts. So just straight up ignored it, basically. Yep. Seeing as the police weren't doing anything, friends and family also began sharing posts on social media about the missing women. They also called local hospitals to see if either of the women had been admitted, but neither had. Then Adam Stone, his parents, and one of Biba's friends, Nina Esmat, went to the park on the afternoon on June 7th to look for the sisters. Nina had been friends with Biba since they were 16, and after a long search at the park, she ended up finding Biba's sunglasses. And she said this, "I saw them glinting in the sun, and my heart sank. I just knew she would not have left them behind." The others in the search party also had that sinking feeling in their gut. Nina went home, but Adam and his parents kept on looking. Adam then found Nicole's sunglasses and left them where they were in case the area became a crime scene. Then his father found a bloody knife laying in the grass. They called emergency services and they were told to end their search and wait for police officers to arrive at the scene. Since the police had done nothing up to this point in time, the search party disregarded the command, and Adam continued searching through nearby shrubs and trees, which I don't blame him one bit.
Same.
Especially since police did nothing and basically ignored them. Yeah. But also, if you're finding a bloody knife and you're finding sunglasses, things are already clicking for you. You know what happened probably at this point. So you're going to want to find them. Maybe they're still alive. Who knows?
I would have done the same thing.
He then caught a glimpse of a pair of shoes in some nearby overgrowth, where he found the sisters intertwined. Stab wounds and blood were immediately visible on their bodies, and it was very clear that they were both deceased. Adam dropped to his knees and screamed. He later said, "I will never be able to unsee what I saw." His mother said, "It was like the whole world stopped at that point." Adam called the sisters' mother, saying, quote, "I found them. They're gone." Here's a clip of Mina describing how she felt when she got the news.
"And I have to tell you that you can't imagine losing two daughters on the same day, no. That anything could be worse than that. It compounded, and I think we sank to a low that you couldn't even imagine."
Adding to the pain of losing her daughters, Mina said the funeral for her daughters was horrendous. They could only have 30 people attend because of COVID restrictions, and to this day, there are still some family members who won't speak to Mina because she couldn't accommodate them in the church. They also couldn't sing because of COVID restrictions. She said this, "It was all about grieving rather than celebrating their life. That had to come later when we held a service at St. Paul's Cathedral for women who have died due to male violence and had a memorial at the park." So just, all the circumstances are absolutely horrible.
Yeah.
Can't even have a proper celebration of life with all the people that you want and need to be there because of COVID. It's just, they're going through hell.
Yeah. In the postmortem examinations, it was determined that both women were stabbed with severe force. Biba was attacked first and sustained 8 stab wounds, 6 to her chest and 2 to her groin and back. 3 of the fatal wounds had pierced her heart and lungs. As for Nicole, she suffered 28 stab wounds. One of the wounds was nearly 6 inches into her chest and went through her breastbone. A dozen additional wounds were defensive wounds, indicating she had tried to fight off her attacker. She ultimately died from injuries to her lungs. It's believed that since Biba was attacked first, Nicole possibly tried to protect her sister, and the victims had abrasions on their backs, suggesting that they were dragged deeper into the woods, most likely to conceal their bodies. According to court documents, the culprit then placed the sisters in a position where they embraced each other, but it's unclear why. It was also determined that both women could have survived their injuries if they had received urgent medical care, but they died soon after the attack. After a search of the park, all the women's belongings were found, including the blankets and picnic gear. Many of their belongings had been thrown into the park pond nearby. This included things like their credit cards, their phones, blankets, and backpacks. When the phones were examined, and this is awesome actually, imagine having a phone thrown in water, yet it survives, and the police could actually turn them back on and examine them. Investigators determined that someone had tried to access Biba's phone after the murders while wandering around the park. Investigators had a theory that whoever was trying to access her phone might have been trying to delete the last few photos that were taken that night. Because on that night, the sisters had propped the phone up and had the camera set on a timer, so it would take photos every few seconds. And this is how they had taken the photographs of themselves dancing with those fairy lights. It's believed that the culprit might have thought that they themselves were captured in the background of one of these images. Unfortunately, none of the images showed anyone other than the sisters at night. But the last photo was taken at 1:13 a.m. just before the attack, and someone failed to access Biba's phone at 1:26 a.m. So this meant that the time of the murders must have been sometime between 1:13 a.m. and 1:26 a.m. Pretty precise time frame right there. Luckily, it's believed that Nicole might have injured her attacker as well, or he had injured himself during the attack, because the forensic team discovered blood samples that did not belong to either of the sisters found on a pillow, other picnic items, on the grass, on tonic water and wine bottles, and on the victims and their clothing. Investigators easily connected the blood through their DNA database, and in the UK, police can take your DNA if you are arrested for a quote-unquote recordable offense, even if you are not charged with a crime. So they have a massive DNA database. Partial match came up to a man in that database, and it was a man with the family last name Hussein. Investigators figured that the suspect must have been a close relative of that man who was in their database, so all the family members were potential suspects for the time being. When the investigators reviewed security camera footage of the family home on the night of the murder, they noticed a young man walking toward the home after the time of the murders. What was odd was that he was not wearing pants, only a jacket around his waist, and it looked like he was kind of concealing one of his hands.
This young man ended up being one of the Hussein family members, 18-year-old Daniel Hussein. His mother, whom he mostly lived with, had a home in southeast London, but his father lived very close to Fryant Country Park in northwest London, where the murders had occurred. His father had also recently expressed concerns to a neighbor, saying that he thought his son had fallen in with the wrong crowd, but didn't clarify any more than that. Danielle was born May 10th, 2002, and was the oldest of four siblings. Reportedly at the age of 15, he was diagnosed with Asperger's, a now outdated term, still used at the time, which, again, I think most of us know this is a form of autism spectrum disorder,
yep.
And he reportedly had low support needs. But he often got into physical altercations with his siblings, several times so much so that the police were called. He was considered a loner at school and didn't have many friends. He was socially awkward, especially with girls, and he really failed in the dating scene. Investigators discovered that Danielle had been referred to the counterterrorism program called Prevent in October 2017 by a school. And this was over, quote, concerns that he may have been displaying signs of vulnerability to radicalization. It's believed that this was due to content he'd been browsing on the school's computers. The government program is meant to de-radicalize and prevent vulnerable people from being drawn into criminal behavior. After further assessment, he was referred to Prevent's Channel De-Radicalization Program, and in May 2018, he was discharged with no outstanding concerns at the time with respect to violent extremism or terrorism. Reportedly, he continued to receive support from a school, health, and social services. Further reviews after 6 months and 12 months after his discharge were also carried out. The murders of Biba and Nicole were not treated as terror-related. But Danielle went on to graduate from high school in 2018 and didn't pursue higher education after that. Investigators also discovered that 3 days before the attacks, Danielle had bought knives and candles from a local supermarket that he was caught on CCTV because they had the murder weapon at the park.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the actual knife itself was a brand of particular knife, and they figured out where this knife was sold and was able to basically track it back to the location to where Danielle had purchased it from. And that's how they got the CCTV footage.
Mm-hmm.
So his dumbass left all of this evidence there, luckily. So it made it fairly easy for police to start tracking down where these items were from.
Yeah. Also considering his blood is all over the crime scene as well.
Yes, exactly. Austin, you know, it can be a pain to keep track of.
What's that, Josh?
Money.
Ooh.
Money just flies out of your account faster than you can even spend it sometimes.
I am flat broke. I put all my money on the Rockies.
Just all of it.
It's all gone.
With the number one losing record in MLB history,
yep.
Austin bet all of his money that there's going to be a comeback.
The Vegas odds were good. I thought I could do it.
What he should have done, though, instead of put all of his money on the Rockies, is just get the Rocket Money app.
There you go.
You know, he could have just tracked all of his expenses, figured out how many subscriptions he's paying for, because you know Austin has a lot of subscriptions, some that cannot be named, because you know why.
Yep.
So, yeah, we love Rocket Money. I love it as well. I actually get on Rocket Money like first thing in the morning. You know, I'm going to the bathroom first thing out of bed. It's just the app on my home screen that I pop into just because it's kind of like makes me feel good knowing I'm not broke. You can track all of your finances all on the Rocket Money app, which is great. You can add all of your accounts, even investment accounts into it, all your checking, savings, you name it. But Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps you find those unwanted subscriptions and then cancel them. They also monitor your spending, and they can even help lower your bills so you can grow your savings. There's so many great features because they'll even try to negotiate lower bills for you, believe it or not. They'll scan your account and actually tell you which ones they can actually go out and try to negotiate a lower rate. So like your internet bill, if you're still paying for cable TV or something like that, amongst a bunch of other things too. You just put in your account info and send it off, and Rocket Money does the rest.
Yeah.
So many great features. They'll also tell you if bills increase in price. It'll be like, hey, this bill's higher than it was before, and it'll send you an email.
Bada bing.
Super nice. I mean, it's such a great app. I recommend it to everybody. Pretty much everybody here at the office uses it at this point. It's no wonder they've got 5 million members who've saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, with members saving up to $740 a year when they use all the app's premium features. So cancel your unwanted subscriptions and reach your financial goals faster with Rocket Money, baby. Go to rocketmoney.com/lightsout today.
That's rocketmoney.com/lightsout. rocketmoney.com/lightsout. Do it now.
He also purchased a balaclava and shovels on Amazon, as well as several lottery tickets from a local store. He later tried to claim that his bank card information had been stolen and these purchases were not made by him. Sure, dude. More security footage showed that he had left his house at 7 p.m. on the night of the murders and returned after the murders occurred. And of course, he had no alibi for that night. Because that's what's crazy about this case, too, is there's literally footage. I assume it's either his home security footage or neighbors or something.
Yeah, it's his own family.
Wow.
House footage, yeah.
His own house footage is picking him up leaving and coming back on the night of the murders.
Yeah, and they also had, they recovered a lot of CCTV footage from this. I mean, they caught like the victims where they were moving. Obviously, they found him at the store as well. There's actually a lot of documented footage concerning this case.
Yeah.
So it added, I mean, it put together a solid time frame of everything as well.
Yeah, it definitely left little question for investigators that this was the guy.
Yeah.
And he used his own bank card, you know, his own debit or credit card for the items that he used in the murder. So very, very easy to track down. But police, they were able to track Daniel down on July 1st, 2020, and they arrested him. And there's some body cam footage of that, which if you're watching, we'll overlay that for you. It's very uneventful. They go to the door, they knock, he comes out. And it's just always interesting to me to watch arrests done in other countries.
Yeah, we're us so Americans, different. We're so used to like violent altercations constantly and just police force and the suspects are always like up to something. It's like, and then watching the UK, like you were saying, they're just, okay, hands up. They're very calm.
They've got a taser pointed at him.
Yeah, a non-lethal weapon pointed at the suspect.
Meanwhile, in America, if they're going to serve a warrant on a killer's house, they're fucking bashing that door down,
right?
Dude. There's dogs, there's guns drawn. It's a whole thing.
They got flashbang grenades they're thrown in. Yeah, it's out of control.
So interesting how different it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they were like, for the arrest, we're going to need an officer with a taser. It's like, what?
Yeah, like that's a big deal. Yeah.
You know, every officer here in America has a taser.
Yeah.
But this is like, you know, serious weapon for them.
Right.
So he gets taken into custody without incident. He's just like, oh, I don't know. I don't know what's happening. But it was like obvious this is their guy because immediately they noticed that Danielle had severe wounds on his hands that looked still pretty fresh.
Mm-hmm.
They were stitched up, but they looked like real, real deep wounds. As far as we know, this guy is not a chef. That's the only place, a butcher or a chef, that would potentially be able to cut themselves on their fingers and hands the way that his hands were cut. But back at the station, when they asked about the wounds, he remained silent for 13 seconds before saying,
I was getting robbed.
Yeah, all right.
Okay, dude. He also lied to hospital staff during two visits about how he got those wounds on his hand. Once he said he was attacked by a group of boys, and I think he even, if I recall correctly, he said black boys. He specifically called out race as well, that he was attacked by a group of black boys, and another time he said he was mugged. He later said during questioning, I feel cold. I'm in shock, man, to be honest with you. I'm really confused and scared.
All right.
When officers searched his bedroom in his mother's home, they discovered a handwritten contract that appeared to be between himself and a demon. Which obviously, police would be like, huh, what is this? And in this agreement, he promised to perform, quote, a minimum of 6 sacrifices every 6 months for as long as I am free and physically capable. Basically promising to become a serial killer. He also promised to only sacrifice women, build a temple for this demon, and do everything that I have promised. He also said he would win the Mega Millions super jackpot.
These things are so ridiculous. I mean, obviously they're terrifying, but I like how in the contract he says, I'm going to do everything that I promised. I promised to do this, and I also promised to do everything that I promised.
Everything above, I promised to do it.
Yeah, it's kind of just stupid.
And then this whole jackpot thing, he's like, that's why he has those lottery tickets,
because
he said that he would win the Mega Millions super jackpot and receive, quote, fruitful rewards of wealth and power in return for those human sacrifices he was going to make. He also promised to never be suspected of any crimes by the police and that they would never even know about his crimes.
Yeah.
He then signed at the bottom in his own blood and left a line blank for the demon to sign as well. So what was this demon he was making this pact with? This demon's name was Lucifuge Rofocale, and in the black magic textbook, The Grand Grimoire, this demon is in charge of Hell's government and treasury, pointed by Lucifer, of course. And Lucifuge, in Latin, roughly translates to he who flees the light. In another contract, Daniel offered blood to the demon Queen Byleth to make a fellow student fall in love with him. Investigators also found a handwritten book of spells and several pieces of paper with symbols on them. Searches on Daniel's computer also uncovered that he had been researching far-right extremist ideologies as well as Satanism and the occult, of course. So what was he looking at?
Yeah.
Because, he's got all these weird symbols and he's clearly doing some, what he thinks is spell work and rituals. And so where is he getting these ideas from?
Yeah. And you can even see like hearts kind of on one of them.
Yep.
And, I mean, if you can, you could probably smell it from here, but okay. So he's promising only to kill women. His other one was that he wants his fellow student to fall in love with him. He's putting hearts in these spells. It sounds like this guy, not only a misogynist, but it seems like that his problems with women clearly fueled this violence. And seems like an incredibly solitary, lonely creature here.
Which is definitely in the makings of a serial killer.
Right.
For sure. That's how most of them start out.
Yeah. But early on, Daniel's history regarding his radicalization and the occult was pretty shrouded in mystery. His motivations for the killings were still unclear. Although he was arrested for the murders, his bizarre occult obsession didn't really make sense to many of the investigators. Seeing that his targets were, like I said, they were strictly women, misogyny was obviously suspected. And since both victims were also women of color, many suspected racism was also playing a part. Detective Chief Inspector Simon Harding said Daniel's demon pact did not specifically refer to race, but he could not rule out a racist element to the killings. Simon Harding also concluded that Daniel's ideology made him arrogant and very dangerous, particularly to women. He said, quote, "He is a young man with an ideology that would lead him to do that with such calmness. He's quite a frightening character. He was speaking online to other people about love spells and potions, and there was some evidence of far-right research. We believe there was a lot more he was accessing on the dark web. But the specific motives and detailed connections for the murders, especially that demon contract, were still unclear until a BBC investigation cracked open Daniel's dark internet history. And as they scoured his digital footprint, they noticed he spent hours every day online. They uncovered posts where he referred to himself as a psychic vampire, and his interest in the occult seemed to spike during COVID lockdown. In one post, he claimed he learned his first spell from a man named E.A. Coetting, and this kind of broke open the floodgates to kind of who inspired him. This was a pen name for a satanic author whose real identity was 40-year-old Matthew Joseph Lawrence from Apple Valley, Utah. And he was raised Mormon, but later became more interested in demons in his teenage years.
Does this surprise you at all?
No.
Mormon and...
Yeah, it's someone going, you know, radically the opposite direction of how they were raised. I mean, we can relate to that.
Yeah, I definitely understand.
But I never went like this far. This is ridiculous. The farthest I ever went was like atheism. I didn't really get into more of like the darker stuff. I know you kind of were interested in
I've definitely dabbled around in some of the occult stuff, not to the extent that this guy does.
Yeah, but still not like sacrifices and stuff like this.
No, I would say more so in the Wicca direction, probably. I'd say is where I went.
And that's a much healthier direction.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Really.
There's no violence at all.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Screw this guy. But yeah, E.A. Coetting, but I'm mostly going to refer to him as Matthew because fuck him, I'm giving him his biblical name back.
Yeah.
But here he is talking about his interest in the occult.
I've always had a push towards the spiritual and the supernatural. I grew up in a Mormon household. We'd read the scriptures every night, and as we'd read about these prophets and the miracles that they would perform, I always kind of wanted to look behind it and say, okay, well, how did they do that? What was their method?
Yeah, the prophets.
Which I totally get that curiosity, right? I've had the same curiosity about mysticism in the Bible, right?
Sure,
like,
yeah.
What's actually going on here?
Yeah.
When it comes to miracles, this, you know, raising people from the dead and all these different things, like, yeah, there's more to that. And there's,
for lack of a better word, like the magic system.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. When you start getting into that, but then it's clearly, you know, non-spiritual ideas, around, you know, gender and race and things like that.
Sure.
That start getting infused into, sort of these occult beliefs of his.
Yeah.
Where, you know, and then it's kind of then taking those ideas and being like, well, if Mormons can do it their way, I'm going to take this information, repackage it, put it in these books that I've written, rename myself, and sort of make myself an authority figure on the subject, for other people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where it becomes dangerous, right?
Right.
Yeah. Is when you've now put yourself in a place of authority over this knowledge that you've clearly skewed with, yeah, your own biases and just your life experiences. You don't know who you're going to influence. And that's where things get a little hairy for him.
Right. And it's always, of course, I mean, if you know anything about Mormonism, it always circles back to the prophets, because it's kind of like saints for Catholics, you know. It's almost like there's some divine intervention. They can hear God speak,
yeah,
to them.
Yeah, it's like the apostles.
Stuff. Yeah, right. They have like, they're a tier above, it almost feels like at times. So yeah, of course you feel small, and then, I don't know, if you're very ego-driven like this guy seems he is, it's like, well, why can't that be me? And why can't I just create my own version of whatever,
right,
that is,
right,
you know?
Right.
But he still sells books and online courses claiming to be able to teach others how to harness black magic and even become a living god. In a promo video on Amazon, he said, "You're about to learn secrets that most people will never know about godlike power." So there's no evidence that Danielle ever spoke directly to Matthew Lawrence, aka E.A. Coetting, but Matthew's books and courses often talk about violent curses and even openly promote murder. He once said, "I don't care if you use these curses to kill people or to kill cancer. It doesn't matter to me."
What the fuck Jesus kind of Christ. Statement is that?
I know, and it's just some like edgelord.
No, look at his fucking
shit.
Book cover, dude. That, yeah, tells you everything you need to know.
Yeah, right.
Lucifuge, the Lord of Pax, 5.
It's so lame.
And he's got this probably AI-generated
yeah,
demon version of himself on the cover.
Yeah, right. It's just,
become a living god.
These people, like, are cornballs. One of his texts, which he had actually promoted on YouTube, advised people to study terrorist methods.
Till the YouTube said,
Yep, they eventually took him off. But he also quoted the Moors murders, which we covered them, specifically Ian Brady, who tortured and killed 5 children in the 1960s.
What the fuck, dude? Yeah. Why would you quote?
He seems like a edgelord, honestly. He just like wants to just be that guy, you know?
What a horrible way to make money, man.
What's worse is that the text was written for an American Satanist group, Temple of Blood, which is part of the Order of 9 Angles. This is a far-right Nazi Satanist group. It's an organization that was linked to multiple murders and UK terrorism cases. As a surprise to nobody, Matthew does have a criminal record and was arrested in St. George in 2014. He pled guilty to possession of meth, cocaine, LSD, mushrooms, ecstasy, marijuana, and being a restricted person in possession of a firearm. Really upstanding citizen right here. One of his books even suggests that the readers follow a specific set of instructions to create a powerful death pact with a demon named Lucifuge Rofocale. He even instructed his followers to sign the contract in blood, leave a signature line open for Lucifuge, and ask for money as a reward. So it was obvious from his instructions that Danielle Hussein had used his lessons as inspiration for his own contract. Danielle was also browsing an occult forum run by Matthew just hours before his arrest. So, pretty direct line of inspiration,
Yeah, well, I mean, if you just look at this guy's courses,
yeah,
I mean, it's pretty clear that,
yeah, line by line, basically,
he's going to take you through it.
Yeah. So it's unclear if Matthew Lawrence has ever been under criminal investigation regarding this violence and hatred promoted in his content. But many believe that if there is no law to prosecute someone like this, there should be. I don't know where I land on this.
I think it's a slippery slope.
Yeah, because
right?
It's like, if you can prosecute someone for what they write in a book, that screams pretty heavy censorship to me. I think.
Then what about movies?
Right, yeah. Even though, like, I don't know, there are publications who maybe they're not giving information like this, like a line-by-line instruction guidebook to, like, murder people. But yeah, I don't like that idea that to create legislation, even though fuck this guy and it's disgusting what he's doing. I don't know if there should be laws to enforce something like that. But, you know, his content has since been removed from Facebook and YouTube, where he had over 85,000 followers. But his content is actually still available to buy on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Some have accused Matthew of being a cult leader, which is a word we love to throw around. But Rick Allen Ross, an American deprogrammer and the founder and executive director of the nonprofit Cult Education Institute, has researched the occult for 30 years. He does not believe that Matthew is a cult leader, but here's what he has to say about Matthew.
What I see is a salesman, an actor. He's costumed, he wears makeup, and he's basically trying to project an attractive, magnetic image so that he can pull people in and then make money off of them. I'll make you a god for three payments.
I love that quote.
No, that's
make you a god for three payments. Yeah,
make you a god for three payments at $9.99.
That's a gold quote right there.
Yeah. Shock sells.
Yeah,
right?
It does. And he even called him an actor or a salesman. I like that. Yeah, this guy's just a schmuck, man. He's just a con artist trying to make a dime off of vulnerable people.
Yeah, he's just another one of those grifters, self-help grifters.
Grifter,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Matthew's followers, like Danielle, are easily influenced and deeply disturbed. It's unclear how deep Danielle's obsession went, considering he did not hand over account passwords and allegedly accessed the dark web. But from what was known of Matthew Lawrence, aka EA Coetting, he promised lonely and vulnerable followers a better life through evil acts. That's for certain. He specifically claimed that the demon Lucifuge could offer things like increased sexual fulfillment, love, companionship, friendship, financial prosperity, and abundance in excess of your needs to the degree of a literal fortune. So vulnerable people like Danielle believed him. I mean, I think kind of rational people like us.
Nobody's seeking out Lucifuge.
Yeah.
Whose life is even decent.
No. But clearly someone deeply disturbed and troubled would, you know, attach themselves to this ideology.
So the fact that this guy knows the people he's attracting,
yeah,
is pretty disturbing.
Yeah. In the words of Mina Smallman, the victim's mother, if you remember, she said, "These sad young men are being fed this toxic masculinity and they're being brainwashed. And that's what he was. He was deluded and brainwashed. My girls died for that nonsense." Couldn't say it any better.
Amen. It's just, yeah, it's horrible. Literally.
Yeah.
Nonsense. Her girls died because of this bullshit this fucking guy was into.
Yeah.
But Danielle Hussein, he got charged with two counts of murder and possession of a weapon. In March 2021, he pleaded not guilty and denied any wrongdoing whatsoever, which was kind of a surprise to Mina and her family. I think they were kind of expecting him to just plead guilty. And so when he didn't, they were like, whoa, says a lot about this guy.
Yeah. And there are some circumstances that we'll talk about.
Yeah, we haven't even gotten to this whole other shitstorm with this case. But during the trial, forensic expert Saran Kara showed the jurors that the blood from the crime scene that did not belong to the sisters and then the blood that Danielle had used to sign his name in the demon contract were a 1,000,000,000-to-1 DNA match. So you got DNA linking him, basically. Forensics also connected the murder weapon back to Danielle. The knife found at the crime scene matched the set that he had bought only a few days before the murder. The prosecution also proved that Danielle had premeditated the murders by buying the weapon, the balaclava, shovels, and tape. Some of these items he had picked up just before heading to the park to murder the sisters. He also tried to hide his crimes by claiming that his bank card was stolen and he had not purchased those items, even though he's caught on security camera footage.
Yeah, come on.
Like, what? How stupid do you think these people are? Not to mention the contract signed in blood where he promised to murder 6 women every 6 months. During the trial, Danielle declined to give evidence, claiming he was not responsible for the killings or for writing the pact. Danielle's legal team also didn't call any evidence about him having autism spectrum disorder or memory problems, even though that's what he initially told the police. The defense also asked jurors not to hold his quote-unquote odd behavior against him, which included interrupting proceedings for bathroom breaks, sitting with his back to the judge, Justice Whipple, and staring at the victim's family and female court staff. He was also seen making an L sign with his fingers directed at the first paramedic who attended to the victims. Just fucking childish.
Yeah.
His lawyer, Riel Carmi Jones, QC, said in her closing speech, "You have seen how he has behaved in court. You may think at times his behavior has been odd. Please judge him on the evidence, not on his behavior in the court. If you have noticed something out of the ordinary, just disregard it," pretty much. Detective Chief Inspector Simon Harding said that Danielle's behavior was like a, quote, belligerent child, and the way he performs in the courtroom is despicable. He also clarified that Danielle was not displaying signs of mental illness before the trial, and that he was simply evil and dangerous. DCI Harding said this, "I'm totally convinced that he would have gone on to commit more murders. He would have been looking at 6 and 6 months if he had fulfilled his contract." Despite Danielle's odd behavior in the courtroom, by the end of the trial, the physical and circumstantial evidence was way more than I think he ever expected it to be. So it was very clear to the jury that Danielle was guilty of his crimes.
In July 2021, Danielle Hussein was convicted of 2 counts of murder and guilty of possessing an offensive weapon. When Mina was asked if she could ever forgive Danielle Hussein, she said, "I already have. I've surprised myself, actually. When we hold hatred for someone, it's not only them who are held captive. It's you, because your thoughts become consumed by revenge. I refuse to give him that power. He is a non-entity to me. The saddest thing is that we're talking about a 19-year-old boy who had his whole life in front of him, who is clearly deluded." In September 2021, he was sentenced to 2 concurrent 35-year jail sentences, and he will be 45 years old before he is eligible for parole. Justice Whipple said the usual minimum term would be 37 years for crimes of this severity, but that she had reduced it because of his age. He had actually only turned 18 about 3 weeks before committing the crime. She said, quote, "You were just 18 when you committed these offenses, and they were your first offenses. You have no previous criminal record in one way. You've already benefited from your age because your age makes it impossible for me to consider imposing a whole life sentence. I have had regard to the guideline on sentencing children and young people, which is not directly applicable in your case, but which informs the sort of reduction of sentence which might have been appropriate had you been just a month younger when you committed this offense." So she took that all into account. She also addressed his autism spectrum disorder diagnosis, saying that it could make him, quote, "a person who could struggle in prison more than others." She also decided not to consider evidence of an undiagnosed personality disorder or psychopathy that was identified in a psychiatric report as a mitigating factor or delay sentencing while these were further examined, because Danielle had refused to comply with the evaluation. After handing out the sentence, Justice Whipple said this to Danielle, "You committed these vicious attacks. You did it to kill. You did it for money and a misguided pursuit of power. This was a calculated and deliberate course of conduct, planned and carried out with precision. Bizarre though the pact with the devil may appear to others, this was your belief system, your own commitment to the murder of innocent women. No family should have to endure this." Following the trial, the Home Secretary, Preeti Patel, said the government must do much more in the protection and the prevention of these abhorrent crimes, especially when it came to the violence against women and girls and how complaints of violence have been handled. All right. The mother of the victims, Mina Smallman, said she would not be celebrating the result, but that justice had been done after several weeks that had been very difficult for her. She also described her daughters as beautiful girls and real people with hearts. And she said this, "Today we remember our girls as the wonderful, strong women they were, and we hope that some good will come out of this horrible story." As for Danielle's behavior in court, Mina said it was all a performance and also said, "There is nothing wrong with him. He's just an obnoxious human being. He is a broken human being who, if he had not been caught, four other families may have been suffering what we have. Well, he ain't out there now, and I think he is so deluded. Come 35 years' time, they will not let him out. I will not let them." As for the minimum age threshold of 21 for life sentencing, she said, "We need to review that separation when someone is an adult. I think it's disrespectful to say that children can't tell the difference between good and evil."
It's interesting. So this sounds a bit like she's advocating for getting rid of that.
Yeah.
Of being able to charge a teenager like Danielle with as an adult.
Right.
Which is similar to how we do it here in the US and most places.
Yeah. And I mean, he technically was an adult, you know?
Yeah, he had already turned 18. So yeah, they still kind of went a little bit lenient.
Yeah, the judge was like considering, oh, well, since it was only 3 weeks.
Yeah, that, I don't think that would happen here either.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. But I mean, that's still it's a long sentence. It's going to be 50, 54 or so in his 50s.
Just to be up for parole. Yeah,
that's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Their mother, Mina, raised questions about why police immediately didn't start looking for her daughters when they reported them missing. She wondered if it was because they were two missing black women and believed that her daughters' cases were intentionally ignored. She said, "They didn't care because they looked at my daughter's address and thought they knew who she was, a black woman who lives on a council estate." The sister's case also overlapped with another case that had gained more traction in the media, the kidnapping and rape of Sarah Everard, a white woman. Here Mina is talking about how race was a potential factor in the case, especially when it comes to the media.
You know, there is a term, missing white girl syndrome. And anybody who doesn't know about that, they need to look it up.
It's pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, that's it, you know. But it's how reporting, how media choose to report one against another. And I made it very clear. I actually brought attention to that because I had family members saying, you know, where was the outcry for two sisters murdered? Where was the vigil? You know, ironically, my girls would have been at that vigil. It's not a competition.
No.
Because my heart goes to the mum. But I've been challenging the media.
Yes.
And I think they're hearing me now. Because I haven't actually met a journalist who has behaved in a kind of mercenary way, not care about us, but, you know, I may do a two-hour interview with a journalist or a film crew to find that it has 2 minutes at the end of a news segment. And we all know that's the point where people get up, go and get a cup of tea, ready for the program they want to watch. Mm. And I've been very clear. I am coming for you and I'm asking questions. And I don't want your guilt.
No.
Guilt's no good. Guilt doesn't change anything. I'm asking you the question, try and make me understand why that story had less significance than this. Because in itself, a double murder of two sisters killed in a park.
At a family picnic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
It's outrageous.
Of course.
I think Mina brings up a lot of really important points.
Yeah.
You know, I know we've probably touched on it a number of times on the show over the years and across really all the crime podcasts that we do. It's a very real thing. We see it on our end as well when it comes to content that we cover and what gets views, what the algorithm pushes.
Yeah.
It's very clear.
It's real.
This is a real thing, which is sad because it shouldn't be. We're all humans. These are two beautiful young ladies that were murdered, and they should have had the same coverage, the same care put in their cases, as did the other woman. So it's tragic that this continues to be an issue, and it's up to people to make that change, and the media needs to make the change, clearly.
Yeah.
If it wasn't already tragic enough that her two daughters had been murdered, this is crazy, but it was revealed by a whistleblower that two Metropolitan police officers who had arrived at the crime scene and were ordered to stay overnight to protect the scene because they decided, since it was so late at night when they responded, that they would do all the forensics in the daylight the next day, that they took inappropriate photographs of Mina's dead children. You can believe that. 47-year-old Dennis Jaffer and 33-year-old Jamie Lewis, they were the ones who were ordered to stay overnight, protect the scene, and instead, they defiled the scene. They ended up taking pictures of the victims and shared them in a WhatsApp chat groups. One chat group was titled The A-Team, and the other was COVID Cunts. Reportedly, 41 other officers were involved in these groups.
Disgusting.
Unreal. Jamie Lewis sent selfie-style photos of himself superimposed with the victims and called them dead birds full of stab wounds. Just
these guys, man. This is the worst, the worst.
It's hard to believe.
Yeah.
On top of that, they had left their designated area to take these photographs. They actually even entered the crime scene, which obviously risked contamination, just to degrade the murder victims. Their actions were not only degrading, but they also compromised the murder trial because the defense pointed out that the officers' DNA samples were not taken and they could have been a potential match to some of the DNA recovered from the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
Which, not to mention, what else did they introduce to the crime scene that wasn't there?
Right.
And the defense is like, could they have brought our client's DNA into there? Could they have planted things? I mean, the amount of what ifs.
Yeah. And this could have been one of the factors into why Danielle pled not guilty. Because it's like, holy shit, we have people entering the crime scene when they shouldn't have been. Who knows what they were doing in there other than taking photographs, like you were saying. Did they plant something? Did they have a vial of blood? What were they doing in there exactly other than just obviously being awful human beings? But this could have completely compromised the entire
everything.
Trial.
Absolutely. Mina Smallman, their mother, later described the officer's actions as, quote, betrayal of such catastrophic proportions, sacrilegious, and for their own amusement. She said this, "This is taking our grief to another place. If ever we need an example of how toxic it has become, those police officers felt so safe, so untouchable, that they felt they could take photographs of dead black girls and send them on. It speaks volumes of the ethos that runs through the Metropolitan Police." Here's a clip of her talking about it.
You just can't believe it.
No.
But, you know, when you get a sense of how prevalent this isn't a one-off. I object to it being said this is one rotten apple. This is not. This behavior is not uncommon. It's commonplace. And the fact that we managed to get it to the Old Bailey and for it to be custodial, I think, is going to change the culture that exists in the police. Not all the police. And as you know, I've got family members who are in the police, and their impact statements say very clearly, you know, we work tirelessly to do the right thing for the public, and we serve. And things like this disgust us.
I have two things to say on that. One, that revelation that they had family members in the police force, that the victim's family, to put that into perspective, they had police officers in their family. And then even if you want to make the bad apple argument, which I'm so sick of. Also, the whole quote is a rotten apple spoils the bunch, right?
Yeah.
But even if you want to make that argument that it's just a few bad apples, it wasn't. there were 41 officers in that WhatsApp chat. And there was only like one whistleblower.
It's a lot.
Yes. So
it's way too many.
So if anything, there's only one decent person in the bunch because it's rotten.
Well, and it's like, it's top down too.
Yeah.
You know? It's,
yeah.
You got to go to the top, the snakehead,
yeah.
Right? And that's how it is here in the US. Usually it's when you see this kind of rampant police shit going on, it's because at the top, shit's been going on a long time. It's just been this generational thing that's happened, and the whole thing needs to be torn down and started over. And just people need to be held accountable.
Yeah.
And these guys clearly thought that they were above the law. They thought that, you know, nobody's going to care. Maybe they thought their superiors wouldn't care.
Yeah.
And so they were so to be. That's just so brazen to go into the crime scene and take pictures and fuck with it. It's just
it's disgusting,
unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, it gets even worse because the messages in the WhatsApp group chats with other police officers also constantly mentioned and joked about domestic abuse. One even said, quote, they are biologically programmed to like that shit. This is just vile people in here, man. It was also uncovered that Officer Dennis Jaffer had also used a racist term for Asians in another message. And Jamie Lewis, the other guy, these are the two guys who were taking photographs. Jamie Lewis did not protest the usage of the slur. The conversation involved an assault on South Asian men. And Dennis also mentioned in another message that he had, quote, let three white fellas go after an off the record chat. This was after that assault.
Jesus, man.
Both officers failed to report each other's criminal misconduct. Luckily, whistleblowers involved in the WhatsApp chats reported the two officers. Both were arrested for misconduct and suspended. The Independent Office for Police Conduct reported that they had discovered more alleged misconduct. Six other officers were investigated for failing to challenge or report the images and texts. Both Dennis Jaffer and Jamie Lewis were later found guilty of gross misconduct in 2021. Assistant Commissioner Helen Ball said, quote, I'm sorry that our officers behaved in such a hurtful, disrespectful, and criminal way. Their actions are shameful. She figured that the public would lose trust and confidence in the Metropolitan Police Force if they did not take these officers' convictions and their behavior seriously. Yeah, you'd think so. And even then, so Dennis, he ended up resigning from the force. Jamie was later dismissed. And in December 2021, the two officers were sentenced to only 2 years and 9 months in jail. And they were barred from working in the police force ever again. But in the end, they only served about half of their sentences.
Of course they did.
Awesome. Awesome. It's so funny to me that they're like, oh, we fear that the public will lose trust in us.
Yeah.
We have to take this seriously. And then they don't take it seriously.
No, they should have been in there the full time at the very least.
Yeah.
And then they should be forced to do something good for society. It's,
yeah, honestly.
Like go for pick once up in their fucking life. Trash or yeah. Something. Like go help somebody.
Yeah. And to put it into perspective from, you know, from the victim's family, Mina Smallman said in an impact statement, it made me think of the lynchings in the deep south of USA where you would see smiling faces around a hanging dead body. Those police officers felt so safe, so untouchable, that they felt they would take photographs with our murdered daughters. Those police officers dehumanized our children. Ever since then, Mina Smallman has worked to raise awareness of the misconduct in the Metropolitan Police and the failures in her daughter's murder investigation. And when the officers tried to later challenge their sentences, Mina saw that they had no remorse for their actions. It put her in such a dark place that she actually tried to kill herself. She said, I wanted to take my life. I woke up in intensive care, but I survived. Afterwards, someone said, how do you feel? And I said, pissed off. But I feel I have now got it. God, you'll come for me when you are ready. I have a job to do first. Jesus, man.
This poor woman and her family have just been through absolute hell. Not only do they have to deal with losing two beautiful daughters, but then these fucking literal pieces of shit.
Yeah. I don't think we've really
are running around.
Yeah. I don't think we've really covered a case that has this form of like re-victimization from the police, right?
No, not like this.
No.
Not defiling victims' bodies.
Yeah.
After Daniel's conviction, Mina said that she would not spend her life hating him, but she voiced concerns that he could be radicalized even more in prison, which is valid. The Independent Office for Police Conduct carried out another inquiry into the murder investigation, and it was deemed below the standard that it should have been. Yeah, no shit.
Right.
It was discovered that a missing persons log was incorrectly closed by a supervisor when the sisters were first reported missing. How the fuck did that happen?
Right.
Doesn't seem fishy at all.
Yeah.
So the inquiries did not begin when they should have. Dal Babu, the former chief superintendent for the Metro Police, said they had failed to prioritize the case, which resulted in searches beginning 12 hours after the sisters had been reported as missing. Reportedly, because of COVID, police had been reduced by nearly 50% in that area, and 16 other missing persons reports were being handled at the time.
That's their excuse for it.
Uh-huh.
Sure, we can take that as a factor, but there's something else going on.
That doesn't explain away just closing out the report.
A supervisor doing it,
come
too.
On.
Yeah.
Come on. He also said this, race certainly played a part in it. People will be asking this question. If this had been a white woman, 46 years old, celebrating her birthday, with no history of going missing, and the family saying they were concerned, action would be taken much more quickly. Metro Police issued a formal apology to the family, but Mina Smallman said that apology was 10 months too late. No police staff or officer faced a disciplinary hearing.
Of course.
What on earth? Isn't it on the superiors of these officers to fucking keep track of what they're doing?
Yeah. Also, why wouldn't they release that supervisor's name? Give me the name.
Yeah.
That person should be shamed. If you're not going to discipline them, then we should at least publicly shame that supervisor.
Here's more of Mina talking about her frustrations here.
They've admitted that there were mistakes. You know, okay, it may never have changed the ultimate outcome. However, we as a family would have been spared the additional anguish and torment. And my son, I called him my son, he calls me mum. He was the one who found his soulmate and his sister. If the Met had have done their job, cared enough, we would have been spared all the additional phone calls, sleepless nights, worrying about where are they? Are they, you know, it's, and now they want to say sorry.
Yeah, it's a little too late for that.
Yeah. Also, if we didn't clarify earlier in the episode, sometimes Londoners, they just call the Metropolitan Police the Met. You'll hear that a lot.
Yeah, if we have any Londoners out there listening, what's your thoughts and opinions on the Met?
Yeah, I'd love to hear if you want to hit a comment on our YouTube. I'd love to see what Londoners feel about the Met.
Or you have your own stories.
Yeah.
Hopefully not, but
yeah.
Wouldn't surprise me. In May 2025, Mina said it was easier to forgive her daughter's killer than it was to forgive the officers who took pictures of their bodies and the dozens of officers who were involved in the group chats and did nothing. She said, they are the ones I will never forgive. Let that fucking sink in.
Yeah.
That is a powerful statement right there.
Yeah.
It's easier to forgive my daughter's killer than these officers. The effects of the murders of Biba Henry and Nicole Smallman are still felt to this day, of course. And the Metro Police's response and misconduct have made many distrust and even despise the police service. Many vocal advocates like Mina hope that change will come, although it won't be easy. In 2022, Harrow Children's Service has set up special awards in memory of the sisters called the Nicole Smallman and Biba Henry Children's Awards in Harrow. The social care team works with the family to make sure the awards are fitting and a long-lasting legacy to their names. But man, this case infuriates me on so many levels. It's just disgusting all the way around.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the police are one thing and then Danielle's a whole other thing.
And it's that idea that believing that someone, whether that's a group, a partner, a friend, that is there to protect you and does the exact opposite of that. That the emotions run way higher because just a crazy dude seeking out problematic and disturbing content, who is lost, who is vulnerable, who is radicalized. We kind of expect a person to murder someone. Unfortunately, that's a sad reality of the world we live in. We do not expect police officers to.
No.
Or we shouldn't expect police officers to behave like this. So it is, I think, you know, she said it's what, a betrayal of catastrophic proportions. Yeah, because those are the people that we literally pay to protect us.
They take an oath.
Yeah.
Literally, they pray over the Bible, you know, take an oath over the Bible that, you know, I will protect and serve and uphold the Constitution and all these things. And, you know, so supposed to take that seriously.
Yeah.
And to see that there's people out there who don't and are really just evil people at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Hateful individuals that are supposed to be the ones coming to save us in our times of need is alarming. And it makes you take a really good hard look at who's really there protecting you,
right?
And who's not. I mean, you see this time and time again in so many other ways too, not just maybe not on the magnitude of defiling a victim's body, but just in the lack of care or empathy that's shown in people's worst moments and worst days. And just, I feel like everything's just become so desensitized all the way around, right? Yeah. It's just like nothing is that shocking anymore, especially for law enforcement. And it's just,
I also feel like, I don't know, my mom was an ER doctor for a long time, obviously dealt with a lot of death. There were no people in the hospital taking pictures of dead bodies and making selfies of it. You know, as desensitized as you can get to something like that, it's still like no excuse for doing something like this. I feel like even us, man, we cover some pretty heinous shit on this show. We've seen a lot. Daniel's seen a lot. I mean, we still don't have that thought process of like, let me just totally make fun
right.
of this in a closed circuit.
Once we get off here, let's all joke around about this. Yeah. It's like,
once we get off of this podcast, we're going to go joke about some cops probably.
Yeah. Yeah. All the cop memes are true.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really disappointing. I think also too, if this is a prime example of the slippery slope that is the occult and the rabbit holes you can fall down very easily, if you're not careful, because there's people like Mr. Lawrence out there who's capitalizing on this shit.
Yeah.
They're like, they're there waiting for you with open arms of like, oh, come on in, just pay $30 and I'll teach you everything you need to know.
Right.
And it's, world's going to hell, man. I mean, shit.
In a handbasket.
It's, it's hard to not feel that way sometimes. It just feels like, man, what the fuck do we do about this?
Yeah. At least Mina does have a kind of a positive outlook at the end. She does believe there can be change that can happen.
Yeah. She's out there, leading protests and I mean, she is a very inspiring individual, somebody who I think we can all look up to. And I look up to just from like a parental perspective of like the love you have for your child, even after something as tragic as this happens, is what really comes through that she's clearly going on for her kids and also to potentially save other lives out there.
Yeah.
And she can.
The fact that she doesn't get hardened by all of this too, because she's very much like have forgiven the murderer. She's also, you know, I still think about this one, is that she even points out in corrections. She's like, someone like this guy might become even more radicalized in prison, kind of identifying even just the problems of like putting people like this in prison. So she's willing to have like this really unique perspective on it that sometimes we don't get to see, especially from victims' families, where just how open she's been and honest about her opinions on everything. And she has gone against the grain in some respect, which must be just hard to do. And so I have utmost respect for Mina Smallman. And I hope we gave her enough of a voice on this episode.
Yeah. No, she's, like I said, truly inspiring. I think we can all, in multiple ways, right? Just her mindset is a good place to be, I think, all the way around. But again, it doesn't take away the things that happened and the loved ones that they lost at the end of the day. That's something that will never be gone. Even with justice, quote unquote, being served, it's not the end. You know, yeah. It's not the end of the pain.
True.
So yeah, really, really tough one. But we're gonna go ahead and end this episode here with a little tribute to Nicole and Biba, because I think that's only appropriate in this kind of case, that we remember who they were, that they were amazing human beings that had their life cut short way too soon. And so out of respect for them, we're going to go ahead and end things there. We'll see you guys next week.
Well, Biba was a senior social worker, a single mum, and she loved her job. She would have been on the phone to me talking about the little lad who just died. And she always said, not on her watch. You know, you couldn't be covering up anything on her watch. And she was fiery like me. So, you know, my DNA. Pocket rocket, she really was, you know. And she was a determined woman to make something of herself. Now, Nicole, she was the reverse of Biba. She couldn't give a damn what she looked like. In fact, one of the pictures of her in the picnic, she actually has a hole in her sock. So if you look carefully, she should have been born in the late 60s, 70s. She'd have looked great at Woodstock. She was more quiet, reserved. But if you got her on her topics, she would fire up. You know, so she had the DNA.